Hi, this is James White once again for the Solution Series, brought to you by Solari.com and Corey'sDigs.com. And I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful and knowledgeable co-host, Corey Lynn. Corey, always good to be with you.
It's great to be here.
It is great to be here. And today, folks, we're going to cover a topic that is typically known as the biggest investment a person makes in their life, usually for the average person, and that's their home. And you've probably seen throughout the years when you have a large item like a house, and there's a lot of equity involved in it. Unfortunately, there's fraud involved as well, and a variety of things that surround that. And our guest today is a mortgage fraud and forensic analyst. And we're delighted to welcome Marie McDonald to the broadcast here. Let me give her a brief introduction. As I stated, Marie McDonald is a mortgage fraud and forensic analyst, a certified fraud examiner, CFE, and a master analyst in financial forensics. With over 35 years' experience in transactional analysis, mortgage auditing, and mortgage fraud investigation, she's the president and chief executive officer of McDonald Property Analytics, the firm, a litigation support and research firm having a principal place of business at 15 Cape Lane, Brewster, Massachusetts. The firm, along with other services, provide mortgage-backed securities research and foreclosure forensics to attorneys nationwide. McDonald Property Analytics also advises and performs services for county registers of deeds, attorneys general, courts, and other governmental agencies. Almost finished here. For over 3.5 decades, Marie and her firm, McDonald Property Analytics, have earned a nationwide reputation as an independent, reliable, and trusted source of information grounded in fact-based analytics that provide their clients with decision support throughout the entire life cycle of the mortgage transaction. Marie McDonald, we're so delighted to have you joining us here on the Solution Series. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Jim, and thank you, Corey. I'm happy to be here. And so eager as well to have the opportunity to speak to your audience. And I do hope that the listeners will also give you a little feedback after they've listened to this session and let you know what they're most interested in learning more about.
Because you are a wealth of knowledge.
Yes. I hardly know where to start.
We had a great conversation yesterday, and I said, gosh, I would kind of like your job, being a forensic analyst, getting to go through and find where they tricked someone, and then having that opportunity to actually beat them. That would be quite rewarding, I would imagine. So there's normally what we do with these episodes is it's all solutions because people are already aware of the issues. In this case, I kind of feel like we almost need to lay a little bit of groundwork so people understand the key. I know you talked with me about kind of three main key areas where mortgage fraud tends to happen. So there's a lot of different directions we can go. And of course, I've got a whole lineup of questions, but do you think it would be best if we start with, so people understand the kind of the three key areas where this happens so that we can then get into how to avoid that and, you know, with servicing your mortgage, the transfer of your mortgage, the forbearance, foreclosure, all of these different aspects.
That sounds like a great place to start. Really, what I like to bring people's attention to right off the bat, mm-hmm. is that when you are buying a home, very few of us actually have enough cash to make that purchase. It's a very big ticket item. And so we have to kind of leverage our future income, if you will, and obtain a mortgage loan to help us with the purchase of that property. And for anyone who already owns their home, from time to time, they may want to go ahead and refinance the loan for any variety of reasons. It could be to take out a little cash to make some home improvements or for some other family need, or perhaps interest rates and monthly payments will motivate them to do so, especially in a falling interest rate market. So in any event, there are entire industries that are very well organized and where the individuals are very well trained to help consumers to buy a real property, buy real estate. And that, of course, you know, we have real estate agents and brokers and national franchises. And so there are all kinds of training programs to educate real estate agents in terms of how properly and within the law to assist people in finding a home and taking them through those steps to actually complete the purchase of it. And then you have, as a complement to the real estate industry, you have the mortgage banking industry. And that will consist of perhaps a loan officer at a local bank or even a local branch of a national bank, or independent mortgage companies or mortgage brokers who will connect you to a source of funds. And so that that mortgage broker or loan officer will take the homeowner's loan application. They will gather all of the documentation needed to underwrite and process that loan application and hopefully approve it. And then to sign the paperwork at closing. And for anyone who's been through that process of signing the 1.5-inch thick stack of mortgage documents.
Oh, yeah.
You kind of will know what I mean when I say it can be very intimidating. And so you have the real estate agent and you have the mortgage broker helping you to put the deal together, sign all that paperwork. And it's kind of like at that point, they love you and leave you, right?
Yeah.
So now what you have ahead of you, okay, it's very exciting when you move into the property and you get situated, you buy the new furniture, you decorate it and you make it home. And then, though, you might be looking at 15 to 30 years ahead to pay off that mortgage. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely no industry that has organized itself or educated individuals such as myself to assist people through the longest phase of this entire real estate process.
Marie, can I?
It's amazing.
Rihanna, I'd like to ask you a question. So back in the old days, before there were banks and before there were all these 1.5-inch thick stacks of paper, it was basically like for sale by owner, just had like maybe a land contract with the owner and they just worked something out. It seems like the simpler way is a way better way, because the new way has nothing but paperwork and stacks of paperwork and all kinds of regulation. It seems like the involvement of these outside agencies has made things more difficult. Any comment?
Absolutely. And that's why there's regulation, because they've made the entire process so complex, and every little step along the way presents an opportunity either to make a mistake or to steer someone. And that's a real thing. There's a term in the industry called steering. And that is where it could be a real estate agent or even a mortgage broker will steer the consumer either possibly to a neighborhood or away from a neighborhood and into a particular type of a mortgage loan that might not actually be suitable and sustainable. And so we could actually at some point have a very interesting, I think, discussion about legislation that Congress has enacted beginning in 1980 and most especially in 1982, that I like to compare it to the gold rush or the land rush back when the Wild Wild West was being settled, sort of anything goes. You just hitch up your covered wagon and your team of horses, and it's, you know, off to stake your claim. And so changes in who could make a mortgage loan, and what type of mortgage loan could be offered, all that changed in 1982 with key legislation. I won't go into it in detail, but it changed the paradigm. And no one educated consumers that, in fact, during the 1980s, there was a complete paradigm shift in how properties were being bought, sold, and financed. And so most of us, well, those who grew up in my generation, baby boomer, my parents, of course, benefited from all of the federal housing legislation, post-World War II federal housing legislation that facilitated long-term sustainable home ownership. But all of this changed in 1982. And at this point, it became very predatory in nature. In fact, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and now we're to the point where everything's done online. You don't even have to go to closings anymore. Just DocuSign everything. And, you know, no one's reading through that 1.5-inch thick stack. The attorney, if you have an attorney with you, and most people do, is just saying, here, sign here, sign here, sign here. And so now we get to the point where some things can start to change over that 15 to 30 years, which I want to come back to the whole 15 to 30 years later, because I have a question on that. But so now, where do people begin to protect themselves? And what types of frauds are you seeing happening? I mean, I know James and I actually know people where these frauds have happened. So,
Oh, well, of course, I've been doing this work. I call it toiling in the vineyards for over 35 years now. So I have been through probably four housing cycles, starting with the savings and loan debacle in the 1980s, which manifested to a large extent in terms of foreclosures in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when I first started studying and working in the field. And so here again, let me just go back a little bit to answer an earlier question of yours, Corey, and that is, so what are these opportunities for things to either go wrong or to be absolutely exploited in this whole process? And I'm going to focus principally on mortgage lending and servicing now at this point. So here again, due to these changes in legislation in 1982 under what's called the Alternative Mortgage Transaction Parity Act, Congress authorized a lot of very sophisticated mortgage products. You might remember back in the early 1980s, and think it was, in fact, I think it was about 1980, interest rates were up at around 20%. So as a way of sort of facilitating real estate transactions and mortgage transactions, Congress allowed these creative mortgage products to be structured and offered to the general public without, by the way, much in the way of disclosure or public education. So at that point in time, the fixed rate mortgage loan, which had been the standard up to that point, let's just say from World War II, post-World War II, up to the early 1980s, now a variety of adjustable rate mortgage products were being offered. Balloon mortgage products were being offered. Discounted teaser rates were being offered. So what is actually happening in terms of the way a mortgage transaction can be structured? These alternative mortgage transactions allowed the bank to temporarily adjust interest rates and therefore monthly payments to make the mortgage loan appear to be affordable, when in fact, when it began to adjust up to market rate, it would not be sustainable. And so, so this actually led to the savings and loan crisis. It was very much a part of it, as well as, of course, speculation, you know, by a lot of people, you know, in the banking industry at that point. But for homeowners, it led to a wave of foreclosures at the end of the 1980s, early 1990s. That led to a lot of attorney general investigations and re-regulation of the mortgage industry. Now, and I remember because I first began studying real estate and real estate financing in late 1986, and in January of 1987, I began a very aggressive period of self-education, and well, where I would take you know, very intensive courses taught by the National Association of Realtors and a number of other things. But what I saw was the relationship between real estate agents and mortgage brokers or loan officers was very tight, because they knew one transaction depended on the other. And using an adjustable rate mortgage, for example, when, let's just say, the market rate was 10%, but for a period of time, the interest rate could be discounted or lowered to 7%. Now, the real estate agents and the mortgage brokers could get people focused on that nice affordable monthly payment on a loan of a certain amount at 7%. But then the way these things work, the interest rate would gradually increase over a period of time. And by the time it got up to market rate, it would not be affordable. And this did lead to a rash of foreclosures in the in around 1990 up to about the mid 90s, as a matter of fact.
Let me ask you to speculate. You figured out that you knew this. You knew that if they were going to do that, there was going to be a lot of foreclosures. Do you think the bankers knew that? Do you think it was done somewhat by design? Because do they benefit when they foreclose? They obviously get the money that the person's paid into it. Then they get to claim the insurance on the whole amount, I believe, of the loss. I know there's some mechanisms. I don't know exactly how it works. But you'd wonder, why would they want to foreclose? That doesn't seem right. Wouldn't they want their customers to continue to make their payments and stay in their homes? It doesn't make sense. I mean, I know why, but please, over to you.
Well, this is a very good question. And it deserves a really great and detailed answer from my experience, because it will help everyone to understand where we are now and how we got here. So yes, I understood that real estate agents and mortgage brokers were putting people into more expensive homes than they could afford if the interest rate were truly at a market rate, and that that this would become unaffordable and unsustainable as interest rates began to adjust. And so by 1991, I changed my business name to the mortgage counselor, because I saw there was a knowledge gap there, and I saw the potential, not only the potential for exploitation, but clear steering, and of course everyone with these mortgage brokers, everyone was being motivated, of course, by their commission structure. And so, interestingly enough, mortgage brokers could earn a higher commission by putting people into a riskier type of a loan. So it's very counterintuitive. Now, the way I introduced the mortgage counselor was by holding a free public seminar at a Sheraton hotel here on Cape Cod, where I live in Hyannis. I had standing room only, and I began to tell people about some of the things, you know, that I had been discovering. And here I am still just an ingenue, you might say, in terms of working, you know, in the field of real estate and real estate finance. By the way, I never became a mortgage broker. I decided that what people needed was an independent financial advisor who had no stake in the outcome of their decision. And so
that's commendable, by the way, for you to take that road. Most people wouldn't have done that.
No, yeah. I made a lot of money doing it the other way. By the way, I have been a licensed real estate broker in Massachusetts since January of 1988. So that's been great because it's a core license for me, and the education I have to maintain, even though I don't practice in a traditional real estate environment where I'm buying and selling. Really, I'm not doing that. I'm strictly an analyst. But in any event, after this seminar, several people came to me who had bought properties financed by these loans that were originated by the Dime Savings Bank of New York. Just going back to the legislation in 1982, up to that point in time, banks could only make mortgage loans in their depository base. That is where they had branches, right? But the paradigm shift that happened here is that Congress enacted legislation that created a new breed of federal housing creditor. And what this meant is that banks like Bank of America, Wells Fargo Bank, what we now know as JP Morgan Chase, the Dime Savings Bank of New York, they could create mortgage subsidiaries who could go anywhere now in the country and set up a mortgage loan origination operation. And so that's what I mean by like the land rush or the gold rush, right? Now they could just go anywhere, just, you know, the country was their oyster. And so in any event, so a number of people came to me with these very complicated adjustable rate mortgage loans offered by Dime. And Dime, the way they sold this and trained their mortgage loan officers to sell this mortgage product, which had a deeply discounted start rate, it made their mortgage product look more affordable and more enticing than any other mortgage product, certainly a fixed rate mortgage product out there. So they dominated the market. And Dime sort of first test marketed this mortgage product in Florida and then came up the East Coast up to as far as New Hampshire and just originated loans all over the Eastern Seaboard here. These loans were structured in such a way that the monthly payment that the borrower would make for the first 3 years would not be enough to pay the interest. And so the difference, so let's just say your mortgage payment is $1,000 a month. That is what you're paying. But the real just interest only payment is $1,500 a month. So the $500 you're not paying is going to get added into your principal. So as time goes by, your principal balance increases instead of decreasing.
It's never ending. You'll never stop. You'll never pay it off at that rate.
Yeah, until they force you to. And then the whole thing implodes, which is what happened. So this is called a negative amortization loan. And this is what Dime was test marketing back in from about 1985 to 89, and then they shut the whole thing down. So I was able to figure out what was going on and why people were ending up in foreclosure when we could prove that they had made every single payment on time, or otherwise they couldn't figure out, you know, what was happening. And so it was some borrowers in a housing complex, a newly developed condominium complex here on Cape Cod, that hired me to audit their loans. And they were so upset they had a meeting with one of their congressional representatives. And I remember they organized media and everything. We met with Congressman Jerry Studs in his office here in Hyannis. And I'll never forget the day I was sitting right beside him showing this Truth in Lending disclosure statement from Dime and showing him what it did not reveal. So the whole purpose of a Truth in Lending disclosure statement is so that you will understand the true cost of your loan. But what it did not reveal is the negative amortization. And I'll never forget the moment when Congressman Studs just pointed at my file and he said, "That is a fraud." And with that, he had his chief of staff take 20 complaints up to the Massachusetts Attorney General's office. And that opened the investigation of the Dime Savings Bank subsidiaries here in Massachusetts. I then went to New Hampshire and spoke to a group of homeowners up there, again, in a newly developed neighborhood, many homes financed with this Dime loan. And met an attorney there who was trying to help them as well. And what I discovered in New Hampshire is that this particular type of negative amortization loan violated the New Hampshire Simple Interest Statute, which would invalidate 75% of the loans Dime made in the entire state of New Hampshire. Well, the long and the short of it is that my audits of those loans led to the Attorney General investigations here in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and then Connecticut, and then to multi-million dollar settlement awards and relief programs by consumers. But now here's the next part of the answer to your question. So by the mid-1990s, I actually paid for the research. Between 35 to 50% of the loans that Dime originated in Massachusetts and New Hampshire were in foreclosure or had been foreclosed upon. And not only that, following up on how much those properties sold for post-foreclosure, let's just use a simple example of a $100,000 property. Dime would sell it after foreclosing, so we're looking at maybe 3 or 4 years later, for $50,000. Well, how does that make any sense? Didn't Dime lose money? I'll never forget the moment. It's one of those aha moments. I was out to breakfast with my daughter and her husband, and it dawned on me, wait a minute. I'm looking at this backwards. I'm thinking Dime originates a $100,000 loan, and the property sold for $50,000, they just lost $50,000. But what if the money had no value until it was infused into a hard asset? Now they just made $50,000. And it is my belief, and I think there's some pretty good evidence if anyone wanted to chase it down at this point, that Dime was involved in helping to launder the Iran-Contra money, as were a number of other banks back at that period of time. And so here I am, you know, very early on in my career, and I have just detected a major mortgage fraud scheme. But it wasn't the consumers who were defrauding the bank, although that's the way a lot of prosecutions were brought, and also the middlemen, that is the attorneys or real estate brokers who facilitated these transactions. It was really all of it. It couldn't happen if the linchpins, the hadn't been taken out from top down. It could not have happened.
And these are still happening. I mean, we still have all kinds of fraud happening today. And so I want to make sure we have plenty of time to get into the solution. So if we can talk a little bit about, we have this chart, James, on the the abuse and escrow account, and it kind of explained to people, you know, the three things we talked about that are, if we can just give it kind of the nutshell version, the short version of how these are, these types of frauds, you know, continue to happen today. And in this particular case on this chart, it's regarding, and I don't know that Marie will see this, will she, James? It's on your other screen, but she knows the chart. She has
it. She won't see it. You guys won't see it. No.
So if you can explain to people how they maneuver this through escrow, so because it's so important that people are alert to the different kinds of frauds, and then you can explain to them how they best protect themselves.
Sure. Well, first of all, just going back to the story I started with, working on all of the dime savings bank loans, by around 1995, and this wasn't strictly relating to dime, as a matter of fact, the worst offender was Chase Manhattan Mortgage. I began auditing loans, of course, which I did starting in 1991. But by 1995, what I found was that these mortgage servicing companies were manipulating people's escrow account to basically trigger or manufacture a default in the mortgage loan. And so this chart, this mortgage servicing abuse and escrow account chart, really gives you the sort of cause and effect scenarios of what can and, you know, does still happen. So this particular chart, in fact, you'll see that I copyrighted it when I was doing business as the mortgage counselor, and it's dated 2003. So now here we come, you know, into the ramp up in the housing bubble in the early part of you know, the turn of the century here. And I created this chart because I was brought in as an expert on behalf of a consumer who was in foreclosure with his mortgage. And he had sold the property, but about $94,000 was held back in his attorney's escrow account pending a dispute over the mortgage that led to the foreclosure. And what I discovered was that the entity that was servicing his mortgage loan account had manufactured a default by, I forget right now what the specific was at the time. My chart will give you a few different scenarios. One way they do it is that, let's just say you don't even have an escrow account. When you buy the home and you take out a mortgage loan, you want to pay your own real estate taxes and insurance, and you've made a 20% down payment, and the lender will allow you to go ahead and make your own tax and insurance payments. Mm-hmm. But let's just say down the road, the servicer sends you a letter. You might not pay attention to it, but they say, it looks like, well, we need proof of insurance. We need proof that your insurance is still in effect. And if you don't see that letter or respond to it or send the proof, or even if you do sometimes, they'll still force place insurance. And that's going to be 2 to 3 times the cost of your regular homeowner's insurance. And now what the servicer will do is set up an escrow account that you never had before. And now they're going to start collecting for real estate taxes as well. So now your monthly payment is going to jump from just your note payment to a considerably higher amount per month, because they're collecting for the real estate taxes and homeowners insurance.
Marie, let me pause for 1 second. I think that Wells Fargo just got in trouble a couple of years ago because they were charging people that even already had homeowners insurance. They were still charging them that extra insurance that you're talking about. And I want to say it caused X amount of people's car payments to bounce and because it took money out of their account. So you have to, my point is, one of the solutions is you have to constantly every month keep an eye on your accounts and what your banks are doing. Because it seems to me like if you miss a month, that could be the month that they try to run something by you. Anyway, that was my thoughts.
Absolutely. And we'll just spend a minute more on this chart and then maybe go to the document checklist. But it's absolutely true. Even if when you take out the mortgage, you want the servicer to maintain an escrow account and go ahead and pay your taxes and homeowners insurance for you, you're happy to fund an escrow account for them to do that. Well, sometimes they will make a mistake in calculating. Well, is it a mistake? We'll see. But let's just say for now, to be kind, they make a mistake and they overcharge you for real estate taxes. And sometimes they undercharge you for real estate taxes, which at the end of, say, a year's time will mean, oh, wait a minute, now you've got a deficiency in your escrow account, and they're going to want a chunk of money to pay that arrearage off, or they will amortize that over the next 12 months, but you're going to have to pay a higher amount every month, you know, to whittle that away. Right. So there are any number of ways that the mortgage servicing company can manipulate an escrow account to manufacture a default. And I can't even tell you, this is right here. This is the number one basis for wrongful foreclosures amongst a population of consumers who haven't had a true hardship, either because there's been, you know, the death of a wage earner, or the loss of a job, or ill health. And so what I learned from my experience back in the 1990s was that these, not only Dime, not only Chase Manhattan, but other mortgage servicing companies were intentionally manufacturing defaults, which I finally figured out was they were testing a new business model that made foreclosure a new profit center. And, you know, it seemed to me, looking at this clinically, and of course I can audit loans all over the country and do. I think I'm now probably in all 50 states. I've audited at least one mortgage loan. And so it's like I'm standing on the mountaintop and I can see what's happening everywhere. Unlike.
And also, probably we've seen over the last couple of years, it amped up even more. And I think, you know, they're wanting to come in and take over land and do their little tiny homes in their little smart cities. And so all the more reason, you know, buying them up and turning them into rentals because they don't want anyone to own anything. And so now it's even more important to be hyper vigilant with your documentation. And I know you have you had another PDF here. We're also going to have other PDFs with great information from you that we're going to include that will be linked for subscribers. So the other one you have here is about being a document custodian, and you have a checklist on it.
Can I just jump back with one thought on this mortgage servicing abuse and escrow account issue? Mm-hmm. The mistake people are making when they see that their mortgage servicing company has improperly managed their escrow account, as I say, either by forcing open an escrow account when they did not have one and they can prove that they've been paying their real estate taxes and insurance, they get angry and they try to communicate with the mortgage servicing company and say, you've made a mistake, here's my proof. I'm telling you, since about 2005, you cannot solve that problem unless you pay the extortion money.
Wow.
It's a really important message for people who do not want to end up losing their home because of a situation like this. So even based on principle, well, wait a minute, doesn't the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act say that if I raise a dispute, the mortgage servicing company cannot negatively report to credit until they resolve the dispute? Oh, well, maybe those laws used to work, but they haven't been working since about 2005 by my personal experience and professional experience. You have got, so let's just say your mortgage escrow, you get a monthly bill. So last month it was $1,200. This month it's for $1,350. I'm telling you, pay the $1,350.
So if you missed the email or the letter that came in the mail that said there was this, you know, you had to handle something or show proof of something, if you missed that and they hit you with this money, you're saying pay that money, but then where do you go after that?
Yes, I'm happy to give you the solution. The solution is to avoid superior court. In other words, don't file a traditional sort of lawsuit against the mortgage servicing company. Here's what you're going to do, especially if you're talking about small dollars, let's just say under $10,000 that you can handle in a small claim court. That's what you've got to do. You've got to pay the extortion money on your check or however you're doing it. You can make a note, I'm paying under protest. Or send a letter saying, I'm paying under protest.
Or just extortion, exclamation point.
Yes, it is, because why? They are collecting more money than you have agreed to under the mortgage contract. That is a breach of contract. Yes, you would have a right to sue them, but you will lose. You will lose because there's so much corruption in the judicial system as a result of everything that we're experiencing these days in all of our institutions,
that
allegedly were to you know, support humanity, they've all been and are suffering from just internal corruption that one person alone can't solve. But here's how you do it. Here's the solution for this, the biggest problem. And if I get nothing else across in this interview, here it is. And I'm happy to help anyone who finds themselves in this situation. So what you will do is you will pay the extortion money. And then you will file a small claim suit in your local district court. And you do have to know something about the laws that govern these transactions in order to set this up properly. But this would be a violation, first of all, of your promissory note and your mortgage, because it's the mortgage that allows those escrow funds to be collected. So they'd be violating your note and mortgage, they'd be violating the Truth in Lending Act, and they would be violating the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act. Now, if you are successful in a lawsuit, let's just say that you brought in small claims court because of the violation of these consumer protection statutes, you would be entitled to recover the cost of your legal fees. You would be entitled to statutory damages, which under Truth in Lending can be $4,000, and under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures can be one or maybe $2,000. You would be entitled to any actual damages. And so if you bring your complaint in the right jurisdiction and you have it properly documented, that is, here's what happened, you know, I checked with, you know, my, taxing authority, and I checked with my insurance agent, and here's what it should be, but here's what they charged me. And not only can you recover actual damages, statutory damages, and legal fees, because these are also violations of consumer protection statutes in virtually every state, you may be entitled to double or treble damages. So two or three times. Wow. And that is the way to win in a situation like this. Don't let it get out of control and don't let them take your home. This is intentional. That's what they want to do by whatever it is, whatever Klaus Schwab said, by whatever it was, is it 2030 or 2050?
Yeah.
you will own nothing and you will be happy. Well, no, we're not going to be happy about this. But here's how I would recommend that anyone who's facing this type of a scenario handle the situation. Because if you stop making your mortgage payments to the superior court judge, you're going to look like a deadbeat borrower. They're going to string that along until you really, it looks like you're a deadbeat borrower. And it's going to be almost impossible to really show, no, this was their mistake, and straighten it out without losing your home or paying tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees and perhaps expert fees to solve that problem.
How important is it to get everything in writing? We had a case here with a credit union. One of the employees called the borrower and said, we're re-updating your loan. Don't worry, you're not going to get any payment information. They created another bank account in this person's name and sent a post office box and sent all the mortgage notes to this post office box that the borrower had no idea even existed. Then they waited until the time was up and then they foreclosed on them. I mean, I think that if your lender calls you and says, don't worry about your payments, we're reworking things, we're going to try to make a better plan for you, you should get all that stuff in writing, should you not? I mean, would that even help you? Go ahead.
Now maybe we should go to the document checklist.
Yes, I can bring that up right now. There we go. Sure. It's ready whenever you are.
Okay, good. So let me look at my own over here. There we go. First of all, in that exact situation that you describe, if that really happened the way you said,
they charged the woman with a crime because of it. Yes, it did happen. They put her in jail.
I mean, honestly, it first of all, under our Constitution, our United States Constitution, we have a right to due process, and notice is an absolute requirement under your note and under your mortgage. So if there are going to be any changes to the contract, you have to get it in writing, and your note and mortgage will say where those notices have to be sent. Okay. And so if a rogue lender actually did something that nefarious to prevent the consumer from getting notice, there's no sort of safe haven there for that lender. I mean, that they would have manufactured a default. Everything is on them. But it is true, it's all about the documentation. So I like to say to my clients, or in an interview like this, it's important to hear that the individuals who contact me for help have two primary problems. Number one is they do not have their documents well organized or at all. And number two, they cannot find a qualified attorney who can and will help them. The latter problem regarding attorneys, to a large extent, is because there's virtually no training for consumer law attorneys. And all of the legal talent is really being sort of drawn to where the money is, to work for the banks, the lenders, et cetera. And, you know, handling that type of litigation, foreclosure litigation, and so it can be, and once securitization became popularized in terms of how mortgage loans are funded behind the scenes, it adds a layer of complexity that simply is beyond the ken. They don't teach this in law school. They don't teach it in college. You'd have to get a master's in finance in order to be introduced to those types of concepts. So it's very difficult for consumers to find a qualified attorney who can and will help them. Now, with the paperwork, it's just so important for people to keep their paperwork. And my ability to help consumers is in direct proportion to the amount of paperwork they can provide to me. That begins at the beginning. So when you sign those mortgage loan documents, whether these days it's in an e-closing that is electronically transmitted to you and electronically signed, you need to download those to your computer. You need to save them in a safe place, maybe double save them on an external drive, and you need to print them out as well. But if you go to a closing, let's just say at a mortgage company or at the registry of deeds or, you know, at the real estate office, they should have a complete copy of all the paperwork you've just been asked to sign for you to take with you. And that's the law. It is critically important to keep that paperwork. One of the reasons that we're finding these days is, especially with these old legacy loans that were originated prior to the 2008 financial crisis, we're still, by the way, we're not through foreclosing on those properties yet. There was such a tremendous volume of loans in foreclosure. I'm still dealing with loans from that time period.
And that's troubling because there's about to be another cycle that's about to hit too. Oh, so you really want to have the first one cleared up, and now we've got the next one that's about to hit.
That's it. Exactly.
So with the documents, I just want to make sure, because I know we're almost coming to an end and I still have about 10 questions I haven't gotten in here for you as far as solutions go. So with the documents we have, and we'll provide this in PDF format, but not just the origination, like you point out, Marie, the homeowner's insurance, the homeowner's association dues. I myself had a lot of issues with the homeowner's association.
Oh yeah.
And, annual escrow account disclosure statement, correspondence, requests for information, of course, all your monthly mortgage statements, and having proof of payments. And so I think that, you know, anytime you can trace back that trail for proof is obviously critical. And so with that, what I'm really curious about is the mortgage origination. So a lot of people go in and they find, okay, I'm going to deal with a broker, or I'm going to deal with my local bank, or I'm going to deal with, you know, Bank of America, God help you. And then they find either that's a corrupt bank, or they sell off your mortgage, which often happens, to some company, you know. And now we've got ESG coming in on all of this, which I was recently dealing with my mortgage, but I just sold, so I'm...
Is that BlackRock, Corey? Is that the same as BlackRock? Is that ESG the same as BlackRock?
What do you mean the same as? Where banks are starting to get involved.
Right, ESG. Yeah, okay.
And you know, I know that's a big concern. And so my question is there a good way of going about seeking out a mortgage lender that, you know, you can trust or that isn't going to sell your mortgage off? Like, where does someone begin with that search so they can at least kind of try to start out on a good path with this?
Right. Well, we still do have community banks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I would recommend. Now, there are a lot of people who won't qualify based upon the underwriting standards that your local community bank or credit union has to meet. And that is often why, for example, if you're self-employed, you might have to go to, you know, a mortgage broker who who has access to a lender who will make a loan and create an exception that your local bank wouldn't. But I would absolutely start with your local community banks, okay, where you deposit your money. And even if you have to pay a little bit higher of an interest rate, you know, an eighth, maybe even a quarter.
Right.
Especially if they will continue to service your loan, mm-hmm. I would do that. Now, local community banks, in order to really serve the population, will have to sell most of their loans to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But they will retain the right to service the loan.
Okay.
And so that's going to be possibly as good as you can get unless you're offered what's called a portfolio loan that your bank or credit union will make from their own funds on deposit. So it would be one of those two scenarios. You'd really want to start there. Try and stay local, like Catherine Austin Fitz recommends. Absolutely. Back right. up 1,000,000% on that. Especially if you maintain your deposit accounts there, you're building relationships. And believe me, in this culture we're in now of dehumanization, you know, right. and creating remoteness, from person to person, live and in-person contact.
Right.
It makes such a difference when you have a problem to be able to sit down, explain the situation, see what can be done, and they will work with you.
Right.
They'll even advocate for you. For example, let's just say the loan was sold to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. They're right there, and they have a good pulse on what's happening in the community, and they can advocate for you.
You know, Corey touched on it earlier, a 15-year or a 30-year loan, and is one safer as far as, do they target 30-year loans more than 15-year loans, or they try to scam people pretty much on both? Is there any advantages or disadvantages to go into a 15-year or a 30-year? I think that's the two, right? That's the two main ones, 15 and 30?
I would say still, yes. So are we talking about fixed rate, adjustable rate, or both?
I guess probably fixed.
Okay. I see the fewest problems for consumers who have taken out a fixed rate loan, regardless of the term, whether it's 30 years, 25, 20, or 15, because, and this is why, a fixed rate loan is very much on automatic pilot with mm-hmm. respect to how your monthly payment will be applied to principal and interest. There's no fluctuation there. And it's so it requires very little human intervention. Okay. And then it's easy enough. You can even do the math to figure out.
Right. Isn't that an amortization table? You can look at the amortization table and you can tell exactly how much, correct?
You can go onto my website. I have mortgage calculators. You know, you can create an amortization table there, or you know, on your bank's website or whatever. And so it's much easier for you to track and follow. Did they apply the right amount of money to principal this month, or did they not? Now, of course, with respect to how much interest you're going to pay on a loan, as I was saying to, by the way, just after you spoke to me about doing this interview with you, a Solari member contacted me. She's going to close on a new home tomorrow, and she just wanted me to review her loan origination paperwork and then the final disclosure, as she goes ahead to complete the transaction. And it was great, because that's really the best time to get an initial consultation. I brought a few things to her attention, no big problems, just tweaking here and there. But she took out a 15-year loan, and she even wants to accelerate the payoff of that loan. So I'm going to create, based upon her budget or her goal, a mortgage acceleration plan that will pay off that loan probably in 10 years. You can take a 30-year mortgage loan so that you can stretch out the required monthly payment just for budgetary purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But you can add money on a monthly basis, quarterly basis, annual basis, and pay that off in 15 years and save all that interest.
As long as you let them know that you want that applied directly to the principal, correct?
Yes,
you have to let them know that.
You have to let them know on a separate piece of paper, you know, apply this $200 directly to principal. Yeah.
In regards to paying off your mortgage in full, what documentation do you want to make sure you have so that you have proof so they don't come back to you down the road?
Okay, well,
I was asked this question by someone who recently went through this.
Okay. First of all, I would recommend that everyone who has a mortgage once a year sends out a request for information to their mortgage servicing company and requests a what I'm going to call a life of loan transaction history. That means you want an accounting from the date you took out the loan to the present time, and do it once a year.
Okay.
The reason I want you to do this is because the documentation, including the monthly mortgage statements that are sent to you every month, or that you can download from the website, the lender's website every month, that is primary source evidence. What that means is later down the road, if there's a problem and you need to say, come to me to help solve it, now I have what's called primary source evidence. That is the documentation you collected at the time it was generated by the computer software system.
Okay.
Because what's happening now, especially if we're looking at a loan that has a lengthy period of say default, it's been through foreclosure, maybe bankruptcy, and it's been sold to a debt buyer. And that's maybe a good conversation for another time, but those debt buyers, the other thing is this, which people will experience frequently. When the servicing of your mortgage loan is sold to another entity, that can happen a number of times during the life of the loan. And every time the loan is sold to a new servicer, that new servicer isn't necessarily collecting all of the back data.
Right.
That can become critically important in the future if there is a dispute, or if you run into a problem, or if you're facing foreclosure, because I can tell whether the lender, servicer, debt buyer is making stuff up because they don't have a complete accounting.
Mm.
And if you've got the best records, you're going to prevail, right?
Right.
It's just critically, critically important. So if a loan is about to be paid off, what I was working on yesterday, Corey, when I first spoke to you, a property has just been foreclosed upon, and money, the proceeds of that sale are sitting in an escrow account. And my client, who was foreclosed upon, her husband passed away in 2014, and of course it created disruption. She wants to know, I think this private lender who made these two mortgage loans to me is taking too much money off the table. Can you help me figure this out?
Mm-hmm.
And so because it went through foreclosure, I was able to go online. I could see all the documents that were filed with the court, and I could analyze those numbers, and I wrote back a very lengthy email saying there is not enough information presently available to figure this out, but I can tell you that there they're charging too much interest in a number of ways, and I began spelling that out. So most people, when they go to pay off a loan, especially like if you're selling a home or refinancing, this is going to be handled by a real estate agent, perhaps, or a mortgage broker, and they're going to request a payoff from your lender, which you may or may not get to see. And so you may or may not get to see the line items. And so you don't actually have an opportunity to challenge that. So what I'm doing in this situation I just described to you is I need a complete accounting. You have $57,000 here in insurance and other costs. I want an itemization of how you get to that number, because I've already analyzed the tax history. The client is paying her own insurance. Where does that $57,000 come into play here? Itemize it for me. And then they roll that into a total, and then they start charging interest on the total. So there are many layers of overcharges in this situation. And, so I recommend, ideally, people would come to me. Let's just say you're listing a house to sell. When you list the property for sale, come to me. Let's audit that mortgage loan so that we know when the payoff comes exactly how much you owe. So that because it's so easy, no one looks at the money. Here's another situation. When a homeowner passes away and they leave behind a home that's mortgaged. So now usually we'll have a probate attorney and a personal representative appointed by the court and authorized by the court to handle the estate of the deceased. They know nothing about that mortgage. The probate attorney knows nothing about the mortgage. It is so easy for a rogue mortgage servicing company to start throwing fees on that don't belong there, and you will have no way of knowing. So, in those scenarios, when a loan is about to be paid off, I think especially if we're talking about an estate that's in probate, it's a great time to give me a call. Sorry for blowing my own horn, but actually you won't know how to figure it out, without a little bit of coaching at least.
I have one last question, if I might. Are there any groups or homes that are targeted more? Do they target people that have more equity in their homes? Do they target people that have more homes? Like, say, for example, it's one of several homes that you have. Is there any criteria that you should be, especially people that are in any situation, they should be especially mindful of shenanigans? Do they target any specific groups or any specific type of homes, and you're based upon your research, or is everybody everybody's pretty much a victim?
Well, you're absolutely right. Certain people and properties are being targeted. For example, there was a mortgage servicing company located in Texas called EMC Mortgage. It started off on its own, and then it was acquired by Bear Stearns. And until Bear Stearns failed, EMC was a pretty big servicer. They would, backed by Bear Stearns, they would buy portfolios of defaulted loans. And the way they would figure out which loans they wanted to buy is use a property valuation model and figure out how much equity there was in the home, and very intentionally select a number of loans to go after, knowing that they can buy the troubled loan at a discount, handle the litigation cost, and still walk away with a windfall. So, as always, elders are targets. Because they're apt to have a lot of equity in their home. They might have taken out a reverse mortgage, and those can be very, very difficult to deal with. And, recently I audited a reverse mortgage loan, and I saw about $16,000 in fees that got sacked onto the loan just as the gentleman was dying, and then after he was deceased, about $10,000.
What despicable people! What despicable people do that to someone that's dying like that? That's the worst part of society. Sorry for my commentary, but that's just that disgusts me.
The abuse. It's part of also what drives me, right? Because really, it's a passion for me. If you haven't figured that out yet,
indeed.
You know, I've always wanted to help the underdog, the little one who's picked on by the bully. I just has always incensed my feeling of what is right, just, fair. But they are, the more vulnerable you are. I mean, women are very vulnerable. African Americans, very vulnerable. I mean, I have a client, a fairly recent client, whose mother has owned a property in St. Louis, and it's on Cook Street, which used to be a very wealthy, thriving Black community. And he began to tell me a little bit about the history, what happened there, and what's still happening now, to try to basically, drive, residents out of those neighborhoods, so that there can be redevelopments and so forth and so on. And so, well, I saw this back in the 1990s with dime, with loans being made, especially, in the Boston area. Well, it's interesting. We actually put push pins in a map to see where dime was making these mortgage loans. It was around technology belts. It was around coastal communities, but certainly around Boston. Sure, make a mortgage loan that's unaffordable to an African-American family who's had that home, for four or five generations, and just move them out of Dodge. So it's a human engineering tool as much as anything when it's, not used for all the right purposes.
Marie, I think we're actually a little bit over time, and that's okay. This has been really and here's the thing, folks, there's going to be a copious amount of data that is going to be, included in the documentation along with this. I mean, this is such a, and I hate to say it's complicated, but it's not complicated when you break it down like on your checklist and you keep records. But the other side makes it very complicated and convoluted to keep the average person from understanding the type of scams that they're trying to run. And I mean, I hate to throw these people under the bus, but there's a lot. I mean, Marie, from my personal experience, I've experienced it personally, so I'm very jaded. At any rate, before we go, I just want to say the majority of bankers out there are probably not out trying to get you, and they're probably not out trying to steal your stuff and rob you, I would imagine. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't be mindful of all these things. And I guess, Marie, in closing, probably the best thing to get across to people would be, if you don't pay attention to your business, somebody else certainly will.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Do you care to close on anything like that, or sum anything up and give something to the folks to leave with, some positive stuff perhaps they can do?
Yeah, I would just pose this question in light of the culture in which we find ourselves these days. Why is it that you don't learn about home mortgage financing, at least by high school, certainly by college, postgraduate work? What you learn is how to make money, why you should buy a home. But the rest of it is if you have not educated yourself about what is involved, you are relying on other people to make your decisions for you. And they have made the process of home buying and obtaining a mortgage as easy as taking out a credit card. It is elegant, right? But does that mean that this is right for you, is going to create long-term sustainable home ownership opportunities? You do have to look a little deeper. And at the very least, you have to maintain a complete documentary file, not only from the origination of the loan, throughout the servicing of the loan. And you know what, James and Corey, at some point, we should do a session where we do a scary letter interview where I talk about why, if you find yourself in default, in foreclosure, bankruptcy, whatever, you have got to open those scary letters. Do not throw them in the wastebasket. If it looks like, well, why did I receive four letters when they're identical? I'll just keep one and throw away four. No, you need them all. But in any event, you know, every time, you know, you're being enticed to look over here at how wonderful home ownership is, but don't look over here in terms of what this is going to cost you and where the pitfalls are. You're leaving yourself vulnerable, and it's just much too costly when it comes to your largest investment and financial obligation. I mean, you're going to pay more in a mortgage than you certainly are in any other type of like income tax, and you need to pay attention to it. So sadly,
and Corey, if you have anything else to finish up here on, I know that you had to step away for a second. And sadly, there are people out there just waiting in the wings to take advantage of folks that don't know, that don't really keep track of their records. It's a numbers game for them. They do it so often. They know they're going to eventually catch folks that aren't prepared, and they're going to end up fleecing them. So you just need to not be that statistic. You just need to be the person that is prepared, so you're not the victim. Corey, are you there? Did you want to say anything? There you go. You're there.
I'm here. Now my dog's urgently waiting to go to the bathroom. I keep telling him to wait. We have important stuff to go over here. No, I just want to thank you so much for coming on with us, Marie. I know we could probably go on for two more hours. You're a wealth of information. We also have included in the PDFs on RESPA on how to stop foreclosure sale by sending in a notice of error. And we didn't have time to really get into that, but that'll be included in the PDF. And so I just want to thank you so much for your time and being here with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure and privilege. Thank you both.
Well, folks, you're quite welcome. Folks, that's going to be the end of this edition of the Solution Series with Marie McDonald, McDonald Property Analytics. That's McDonald Property Analytics. And we're going to have Marie's information on the documentation where you can call her if you need assistance for your very own self. You'll be able to reach out to Marie for that. We want to thank you for looking in here. If you're interested in finding out more about these programs, you can go to coreysdigs.com or solari.com. And until next time, we appreciate you looking in. This is James White for the Solution Series, saying bye now.